This is lecture number 9 of Alan McCrae, The Prophecies of Daniel, lecture number 9. Now here's a question I was given at the end of last hour that I think is very important. Somebody asked, and I quote the question, Dr. McCrae, why do you call the fourth king Xerxes the first when verse 1 talks about Darius, and then verse 2 says, now I will show you the truth, there will stand yet three kings, and then the fourth. It seems that the fourth would point to further kings away from Darius, and not to the next king, who is Xerxes the first. End quote. Now, this is a very important question, because there is a matter that I have mentioned but not stressed, that if you don't have clearly in mind, you could have some confusion. You might say that there are two elements that enter into my saying this. The first is that we have noticed chapters 10 to 12 form sort of a unit composed of these three chapters. The first verse in chapter 11 belongs to what precedes rather than what follows. But the second point is this, that this, quote, Darius the Mede is a different person than what is called, quote, Darius the King of Persia, end quote. Darius the Mede seems to have been a man whom Cyrus put in charge of the kingdom of Babylon after he conquered it. Most interpreters think it was a man named Gobryath who was mentioned in one of Cyrus's inscriptions. One recent writer thinks it was another name for Cyrus himself. But this, quote, Darius the Mede, end quote, is different from the Persian king Darius, who was mentioned on the sheet of facts of ancient history that I gave to you earlier. So it is very good to have that clearly in mind, and I appreciate greatly having this question. It helps me clarify the situation. Now, the answers to the test that I gave you 2 weeks ago, I wasn't able to discuss last week because I was away quite a bit of the time between the time you took the test and our meeting. But now they have been carefully gone over by me. Some of them were very good, and some of them were quite disappointing, I'm afraid to say. I believe that it would be helpful to take some time to look at these questions, so we'll take a few minutes and look at the different questions together. I think I'll start with the questions that were given to people with odd number seats. The first of those was, quote, briefly state the critical theory regarding the meaning of Daniel's predictions, end quote. And this can be briefly stated in about 2 sentences, but it is quite important at various points of our interpretation of Daniel's prophecies that we have this straight. Our purpose in this class is not to discuss the critical theory per se. We believe that this is a book that God inspired, but the various critical theories postulate that it was not written by Daniel, but written by somebody else about 2 centuries later that was passing himself off as Daniel, writing back at the time of Nebuchadnezzar. We've been over this. We could spend a good deal of time on the evidences, but I believe that the evidences are not sufficient to raise great doubt about Daniel's having written this book. But there are many commentaries written from this critical viewpoint, and it does affect their interpretation at many points. So it is vital that we have a clear understanding of what the critical theory is, even though we don't go into it in great detail. And the critical theory, which was advanced at least as early as the 2nd century AD, and which, by the way, was answered by Saint Jerome in the 4th century AD, this critical theory is that the book of Daniel was written sometime about 160 BC. And that it was written in order to encourage the Jews at the time when Antiochus Epiphanes, a Seleucid king, was persecuting them. The theory states that Daniel was passed off as written by a man 3 centuries earlier as predictions which the writer knew had already happened. And so the writer of Daniel gives past history as if it were a future prediction. But when it comes to Antiochus Epiphanes, the writer gives a true account of him and his reign up to a certain point, but then beyond that, he just gives the guesses of himself, the writer, and his hopes as to what might occur after 165 BC. This critical view affects a great many commentaries on the book of Daniel. For instance, I mentioned before F. W. Farrar, whose book, quote, The Life of Christ, end quote, is very highly regarded by many, and he has written a commentary on Daniel, which was written from this critical viewpoint, that the book was written in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And so it should not take long to briefly state the theory, but it is very important to have it in mind. Then the second question was to discuss the meaning of the word, quote, "You are this head of gold," end quote. There are a few students who gave some interesting words about the importance of words and the high great importance of King Nebuchadnezzar and that sort of thing, which is rather obvious, but not what we discussed in class under the discussion of this verse. I pointed out at that time, as shown on the sheets of facts of ancient history that I gave you, that Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by evil Merodach, who was succeeded by Nergalesser, who was succeeded by Labashi Marduk, who was succeeded by Nabonidus. And so if the head of gold means Nebuchadnezzar himself personally, then there are three kings after him before the next kingdom comes. You can say the next kingdom is his son, who reigned only about 3 months, and then the third kingdom would be the next king of Babylon, who reigned for 4 years, and then the fourth kingdom, his son, who reigned about 3 months. That, of course, would be absurd. So it is clear that either there is a break between Nebuchadnezzar and then an unmentioned interval between him and the second kingdom, which it says, quote, "will come after you," end quote, or, as I think much more likely, when Daniel says, quote, "you are this head of gold," end quote, he does not mean Nebuchadnezzar personally, but he means Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And that could mean the period of Neo-Babylonian Empire, these five kings together. Or I think even more likely, it is the whole period of the Assyrian and Babylonian Empire together. Now, we discussed that some time ago, but I wish you would review it because it is very important for the understanding of the prophecy. The next question was, quote, "discuss the meaning of Daniel chapter 7, verse 12, end quote. And someone came up to me and said, quote, "didn't you mean Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, not verse 12, end quote. Well, we discussed Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 at length. We spoke briefly about Daniel chapter 7, verse 12. And verse 12 says, well, we might look at the precise words of it. It is a verse which, if not carefully interpreted, could be rather baffling. Because after telling about the destruction of the great beast, it says, "as for the rest of the beasts, that they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time." Does this mean that when the great beast was killed and his body burned, the other beasts continued on? That wouldn't make much sense, would it? So it was clearly Daniel's looking back on his vision and remembering the fact that the other beasts, when their dominion was taken away, they lived on. In other words, their qualities remained on, embedded in the succeeding rule. So all four beasts make one continuous history of human sin and human wickedness ruling over the earth. The governing qualities of all four beasts are destroyed when the last, when the great beast, is also destroyed. That, of course, is clearly brought out in chapter 2, when it says the stone hit the statue of gold, silver, bronze, and iron mixed with clay. They were shattered, all these materials, that is, and all dissolved and were blown away. And so that was a difficult point with this verse the way it stands, and we took a little time to explain it, and I'm sorry that some of you did not remember the explanation. Well, question number 4 was, quote, "briefly tell what is designated by the term Ancient of Days in each occurrence in Daniel chapter 7, end quote. Of course, when I say in each occurrence, I meant that to mean that you show the difference between the occurrences. It is quite obvious that Ancient of Days means one who has existed way, way back, the Ancient of Days. That, of course, is obvious. In the context, we learn that the Ancient of Days is one with tremendous power, 1,000 times greater, 1,000,000 times greater than any human being has ever had. But in this chapter, as we notice, this Ancient of Days is mentioned 3 times. And in the first occurrence, it is, to my thinking, very obviously describing the triune God. Now, of course, Someone may say that this is not the triune God, this is God the Father. I would not count that 100% wrong, but I certainly do not think that Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit are so inferior to God the Father that a picture of God as the great powerful one controlling the universe means only God the Father. And in the Old Testament, great stress is laid on the fact that there is only one God, which is constantly stressed in the Old Testament and certainly never denied in the New Testament. There is one God. And so it would seem to mean that the Ancient of Days in verse 9 must be the triune God. I believe in the Old Testament, wherever it says God, it means the triune God, unless there is something in the context that clearly shows that it indicates one of the persons of the Godhead. And we find this term, Ancient of Days, again where it says that one like the Son of Man has come to the Ancient of Days, or had been brought here before the Ancient of Days, and had been given dominion, glory, and the kingdom. And that very obviously refers to the Lord Jesus Christ, who is being brought before the Ancient of Days. And so, the Ancient of Days here cannot mean the triune God, and must mean God the Father in this reference. And then the third reference is in verse 22, where it says that the little horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came. And that obviously is a reference to the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. And so, there the Ancient of Days is one person of the Godhead, the second person of the Godhead, the Lord Jesus Christ. So when I said in each occurrence, I was happy if you told about all three, and very unhappy if you only made a general statement about this phrase, the Ancient of Days. Oh, yes, yes, the Ancient of Days, the first one, is a mention of the great, glorious, triumphant God who is in control of all things, and that is certainly the triune God, not one person of the Godhead. Well, it's pretty hard to say. Some might say the fact that it says thrones were there and nobody else represented as sitting on the throne might suggest the idea of the Trinity, but I wouldn't want to build too much on that. But unless you do, it's pretty hard to explain why it does say thrones, because there's not one mention of anybody sitting. But certainly, it is the triune God in the first occurrence, whether you have one throne or three. It is figurative, of course. It is not literal. And the second instance of the Ancient of Days shows the Son of Man brought before the Ancient of Days and given authority. That must be Christ who sits at the right hand of God the Father. And the third one is the coming of the Ancient of Days to establish the kingdom on earth. And that certainly must be the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, yes. And so let me recapitulate. The first occurrence of the Ancient of Days is the triune God. The second is God the Father, and the third is Jesus Christ. I do believe that is correct, and that is what I was looking for on the exam. And then question number five was, quote, briefly mention various possibilities as to what is indicated by Daniel chapter 2 by the stone and the effects of the stone, end quote. And we notice various possibilities which might be mentioned. One of them was Islam, that is, the Islamic Empire. One of them was the papacy. And then one, of course, is the idea of the Christian church as the stone that becomes gradually growing until it fills the whole earth. And another is that the stone that comes and hits the statue on the feet refers to the second coming of Christ, utterly destroying all the evil that is involved in human government and substituting a righteous government of the saints. There were those four various possibilities which could be briefly mentioned. But then I said, quote, as far as time permits, discuss the two most probable, end quote. And as we notice, the first two, that is Islam and the Christian church, have been proven impossible by the fact that neither of them carry true. And so it is very obvious one of the last two, and to my mind it takes a great deal of twisting of the statements to represent the stone as the Christian church, and of course, it is very intriguing to suggest that the stone cut without hands represents the virgin birth. If so, there is a long break between that and its hitting the image, because the virgin birth happened at the very beginning of the Roman Empire when the Christian church began. No one can say humanly that it is impossible that the Christian church may so grow and so many people can be converted that the whole world would be won to Christ and thus the kingdom of glory and happiness and peace established. But it certainly doesn't look that way, and there is no promise I know of in the Bible anywhere that such a thing is going to happen. And so it fits the imagery far better to say that it represents the coming of the Son of Man on the clouds of heaven, putting an end to all that was represented by the four beasts and establishing the kingdom of the saints. So, instead of the stone being cut without hands representing the virgin birth, in my mind, it represents the second coming of Jesus and the establishment of his kingdom. Now, those were the questions given to the people with odd numbers. Now, with even numbers, the first question was, quote, discuss the meaning and purpose of Daniel chapter 7, verse 4, end quote. There, in connection with Daniel 7, verse 4, we discussed here in class that the first beast was, quote, like a lion and had eagle's wings, and I beheld till its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, end quote. You might say right away, well, here's the destruction of the Babylonian Empire. Its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth. It's the destruction of the Babylonian kingdom, right? But as we pointed out, there is nothing said about the destruction of any of this first three beasts. Nothing said about such a thing. So we won't take it as a destruction of the Babylonian kingdom unless we're sure. And so we looked further, and we find that this beast was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on his feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to him. But that's no way to destroy something, to give a beast a man's heart. But when, as I pointed out, when we look back to the fourth chapter of Daniel, we find there the story of how Nebuchadnezzar was given a period of insanity in which he groveled on earth like an animal and ate grass, and then God gave him his sanity back, and he stood up again, and God gave him a man's heart, and he had his kingdom back again. This, we pointed out, would seem not to be a picture of the destruction of the Babylonian Empire, but a reference to an event that had occurred in the course of the history of the first kingdom, which Daniel had seen and had been connected with, and knew that it would give him further assurance that the rest of the dream or the vision would also be carried out. Then the second question for those with even numbers was, quote, what past time would best fit the description of the second phase of the fourth kingdom? Give reasons for and against, end quote. Now, if this was a course in history, and I asked you to discuss the history of the Roman Empire, but you gave me a very beautiful description of the Hellenistic Empire, I might say, quote, well, you just misread the question. It's a good account of what you thought the question meant because you looked at it carelessly, and so we won't take a whole lot of points off, end quote. But this is a course in exegesis. And if you go to exegete the Bible, you should be able to exegete a question on a test. And so, when I ask for what past time should fit the description of the second phase of the fourth kingdom, if I got an answer which mentioned the various interpretations of the meaning of the stone, why, I couldn't give you any credit for that, naturally, because that's about as bad an exegesis of a question as you can possibly make. We saw how chapter 2 had the static thing, the four parts of the statue. Then there's the second phase of the last kingdom, that is, the feet of the statue, and we saw how the dynamic events occurred with the coming of the stone. And so those who had the even-numbered questions and gave an answer to question 5 of the odd-numbered questions could hardly get credit for that particular question. But the pastime that would best fit the description is very obvious. As I think I stated several times in class, it is the period from AD 400 to 600. At that time, the Roman Empire was in rapid decline, and there was a great mixture of Germanic peoples marching through the Roman Empire, back and forth, pillaging and destroying, setting up kingdoms, and then destroying each other's kingdoms. This would exactly fit the situation, except that it says that, quote, there shall be in it some of the strength of the iron, end quote. But contrarily, there was no strength in the Roman Empire, as we can see in that 200-year period from AD 400 to 600. And the statement, quote, "they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men," end quote, could fit any time at all, or else must mean that some very unusual thing is going to happen, and if so, we don't know what it would be in connection with the empire. But most important against this interpretation of this period being the second phase of the fourth kingdom is the fact that it specifically says that the stone strikes the image on its feet of iron and clay. And right at the end of that time, the only thing that could be said to be the stone would be the coming of Islam, which did not carry through, quote, "covering the whole earth," end quote, as the stone would. Or shortly afterwards, possibly, 4 centuries afterwards, the development of the power of the papacy might be seen as the second phase of the fourth kingdom. But this also was not carried through until the end of time. And so it would look as if what is meant by the second phase must be something still future. Now that was question number 2. The second half of the Roman Empire, the second phase of it rather, is a period described by the iron and the clay being mixed together. And that could well fit the condition from AD 400 to 600, as I have said. And so that would be what the second phase would represent. The question wasn't about the stone, it was about the second phase. But then I gave reasons for and against this view. The reason for it was that this period fit the description given in Daniel very well in general. But the reason against it was that it does not completely fit because there was no strength in the Roman Empire at that time, and because of that particular phrase, quote, "mingling themselves with the seed of man," end quote, does not represent anything different from that which has all been present in other periods. But more importantly, this AD 400 to 600 period was not followed by the coming of the stone. So, in discussing the second phase as to what it is, we don't think it's this period of 400 to 600 AD because nothing came immediately after that could be seen as the coming of the stone. So, what I just referred to would be the simple answer to the question. But there were 2 additional things that might have been said, but were not required, but might have been good if one said them. One was this: that the critics say the second phase of the fourth kingdom fits the latter part of the time of the Seleucids, the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, and that it would in many ways fit that period. But, of course, the fact is that the Seleucids fit the third kingdom rather than the fourth, so that is not a satisfactory answer, but a very good one if you happen to think of it and mention it as a possibility after you mentioned the main possibility of AD 400 to 600. The other thing you could say is that the second phase, if it isn't just 400 to 600, it's either something future, or you might say it starts at 400 and reaches right on to the very end. Either way would be perfectly all right with me. Now the next question, again for the even-numbered questions, the third question, was briefly state whether the statue represents 4 kingdoms or 5. As you look at chapter 2, you cannot tell whether the statue represents 4 kingdoms or 5. That is to say, there is a difference between the last 2 parts of the statue as described in chapter 2 of Daniel. And so it could be 5 kingdoms, and yet the last 2 parts both have iron in them, so it could be 4 kingdoms. So as far as chapter 2 is concerned, you can't really tell whether it is 4 kingdoms or 5 kingdoms, even though there are 5 parts to the statue. But when you take chapter 7 into account, there you have only 4 beasts and not 5. And the fourth beast is destroyed, just as in the 5th part of the statue in chapter 2 is destroyed. So it would be reasonable to say, because of the parallel in the 2 chapters, that the statue represents 4 kingdoms and not 5. That is the answer to the question that I would have liked in question number 3. And then the fourth question for the even numbers was, quote, "In the time that remains, point out the relation of known facts of history to the predictions of Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 7," end quote. Now, in relation to that, most of the facts that would have helped are on the sheet that I gave out, but I did not mean that I wanted you to memorize all those dates or all the names on the sheet. But the main features of the relevant history are on it. For instance, Alexander the Great founded the Hellenistic Empire. He had no connection with the Roman Empire, which came centuries later. But all I wanted were just the main historical facts. Some did very well, and some, I'm afraid, didn't do very well at all. Now, of course, if you had ancient history in college, it should be easy to do well on this exam question. If you didn't, it would be worth a little extra time looking at this sheet, and if that wasn't clear, perhaps looking at an encyclopedia or a history book and getting a little clearer idea of what happened at this time would be helpful to you. Well, we better move on or we won't have time to finish what the prophecies of Daniel were all about. That is, we won't have time this year to do that if we keep stressing the answers to the questions. I have always said that it is better to have a thorough knowledge of Greek than to have a smattering of Greek and a smattering of Hebrew. I think that it is absolutely certain that I am right. I hope that you'll all know both well, but a smattering of both won't do you any good. Now, here I would say, to get a good understanding of chapters 2 and 7 and know nothing about the rest of Daniel would be much more valuable than to have a slight smattering of chapters 2, 7, 8, 9, and 11. That is, out of those chapters, even out of the whole book, I think chapters 2 and chapter 7 are the most important. So I hope those of you who have had difficulty with some of these questions will review them and get your knowledge more thoroughly in line with the questions. But we were discussing at our last meeting Daniel chapter 11. And in chapter 11, we had noticed how it begins with the Persian attack on Greece. Greece is only named three times in Daniel and only once in the rest of the Old Testament. But here, Greece is specifically named in this 11th chapter, and it mentions how Darius and Xerxes made a great attack on Greece in order to protect the parts of Asia Minor that they had conquered. And then, in chapter 11, verse 3, we read, quote, "A mighty king rose up and ruled with great dominion and did according to his will," end quote. Everyone agrees that that is a reference to Alexander the Great. And then number 3 of the outline, quote, "the dividing up of Alexander's empire," end quote. I had given you a statement last time about the great breakup of his empire and how it occurred, and a little bit about the subsequent history, so we won't take a whole lot of time to recapitulate at this point. But I do hope that you have in front of you the sheet that I gave, because we want you to go on to look at capital C over the outline, quote, "the Seleucids and the Ptolemies," end quote. And I'm going to make subheadings under them because we will simply look at the verses. And so we find the beginning of the descriptions of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies in chapter 11, verse 5, where it says, quote, "the king of the south shall be strong," end quote. No one need have any questions what is meant by the king of the south. When you have a division of Alexander's empire, Egypt was much farther south than any other part of the empire, and the general who took control of Egypt, who was named Ptolemy, was certainly one of the most powerful of the successors of Alexander. Quote, "so the king of the south shall be strong, and so will one of his princes," end quote. These prophetic statements all through this are quite clear when you look back at what happened. By contrast, they would not be so clear looking ahead at the time of Daniel. You wouldn't know exactly what was going to take place. But this is like many of the prophecies of Christ. It would be very hard to write a life of Christ simply from the Old Testament prophecies. But after the events occurred, you see how exactly these prophecies fit with so many of his actions. That gives the assurance to us that this was indeed what the Lord had predicted. And so here are the statements that, quote, "one of his princes will be strong, and he shall be strong above him," end quote, which refers to Ptolemy, obviously does not mean that Ptolemy will be stronger than one of his princes. It must mean that one of his princes will be stronger than he. And we know historically that Seleucus, or Seleucus as people call him, after working for Ptolemy for a time, saw his opportunity and went back to Babylon, where he had previously been in charge. And in 312 BC, Seleucus established himself in Babylon, and after establishing himself there in 312, his successors continued to rule for centuries thereafter. The dates seem so important because it's the first time in history that we know of that people have measured dates many generations beyond one king's reign. In ancient Egypt, we read that in the 25th year, in the reign of Ramses II, for example, something happens. And then we read in the 5th year of Merneptah, something else happens. But we don't know how many years are in Merneptah's reign after a date in his father's reign, unless we know how long his father lives. So in this very simple thing, it might seem to us simply to number years right along as we do year after year, but that never seems to have occurred to anybody in ancient times. It was probably more or less by accident that Seleucus measured from the time when he went to Babylon in 312 BC, and when his son Antiochus became king, instead of saying that things happen in such and such a year of Antiochus, people just continued the numbering right straight along, as was used by Seleucus, who started his dates, or calendar, in 312 BC. And that numbering was continued by some as late as 1600 AD. It is the longest continuous system of chronology that the world has ever seen. And some Hebrew manuscripts even, some Hebrew manuscripts of the Bible, are dated, as they say, in the year 2612, which means 2612 years after Seleucus went to Babylon in 312 BC. But the unfortunate thing is that sometimes the Hebrew manuscripts don't bother to give the thousands of the date, and so instead of saying 2612, they'll just say 612, or they might even just say 12. Just like we sometimes give the last two digits of our year, for example, 1976, we'll just say 76. Everybody knows it's 1900 years after Christ. And so sometimes you know the exact year a Hebrew manuscript was written, but you don't know what century it was. But it starts in when, in 312 BC, Seleucus or Seleucus went to Babylon. So this prophecy of Daniel was very exactly fulfilled, quote, "He shall be strong above him," end quote, as Seleucus was stronger than Ptolemy because he had a lot of power. Ptolemy had Egypt, but Seleucus had all the territory reaching way over to India. He had everything from Asia Minor there and farther to the east all the way to India, as I mentioned. So he had a tremendous area that he held, large as all the rest of Alexander's empire put together, and this was the area that Seleucus held. So this statement, quote, "He shall be strong above him," was very remarkably fulfilled, along with the statement, quote, "And his dominion shall be a great dominion," end quote. And then we go on to verse 6 of chapter 11. This jumps forward. There is an unmentioned interval between verse 5 and verse 6 of chapter 11. And I hope all of you have the little chart before you that I handed out. Look at the left side of the chart where I have the kings listed. It shows how Ptolemy I died in 283 BC and Seleucus I died in 281 BC, just 2 years later. So, Ptolemy II reigned during the last part of Seleucus' reign, during all of Antiochus I's reign, and during most of Antiochus II's reign. We find here the statement, quote, "at the end of years," end quote. Does that mean the end of the world? The end of years? There are people who would interpret such a phrase in that way sometimes. But certainly it doesn't mean that here, because here it means after a while, after quite a while later, because it skips ahead from Seleucus, who went to Babylon in 312 BC, and it goes all the way clear down to the latter part of the reign of his grandson, Antiochus II. Now, you couldn't tell that just from the prediction, but we know that it did happen historically, and this fits in with what is stated here. Quote, At the end of years, they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. End quote. And there was clashing between these two empires, that is, between Egypt, ruled by Ptolemy II, and the Seleucid kingdom, ruled by Antiochus II, each of them wanting to get more of the territory the other had. But the time came when Seleucus's grandson, Antiochus II, and the now very elderly Ptolemy II, who was known as Ptolemy Philadelphus, decided not to keep fighting amongst themselves, but to make a friendly alliance. And so they came together, and the king's daughter of the south, that is, Ptolemy II's daughter, came to the king of the north to make an agreement. And we find that Antiochus II agreed that in order to cement this alliance, that he would marry the daughter of Ptolemy II, whose name was Bernice. This Bernice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, came up there to marry Antiochus II. They, as the verse goes on to say, quote, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, and he that strengthened her in these times. End quote. I know that sounds a bit convoluted, but we'll go on and analyze what happened. Again, we never know what that means just from looking at the prophecy. But as you look back, you find that when Bernice came up to the king of the north, she married the king, but he already had a wife, and his wife had grown sons. And the wife didn't like what Antiochus II did a bit, that her husband had married this daughter of the king of Egypt. And so, his first wife left Antioch, where he was living, and she went to Asia Minor, which also belonged to Antiochus II, and she lived up there in Asia Minor with her grown son, also called Antiochus, while Antiochus II, the son's father, was with Bernice. And Bernice also had a child, but Laodice, that is the name of his first wife, was afraid that he would make this child of his second wife Bernice king after him, rather than his first child by Laodice. And so she did not like at all what was happening, and a great many of the people, quite frankly, felt that she had been mistreated. And the result was that after a while, he got tired of Bernice, and he went back up to Asia Minor to be with Laodice. But then she was still afraid that he might make his child by the daughter of the king of Egypt, that he might make him king, and so it was generally believed that she poisoned him. At any rate, he died. And when he died, she managed to have some of her people get a hold of Bernice and kill her, too. And so we read that, quote, she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begot her, end quote. And that means that her father died, that is Ptolemy II, at about the same time that Bernice, his daughter, was killed. And so verse 7 says, quote, out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, end quote. Now, what would be meant by, quote, a branch of her roots, end quote? Well, her roots would be her father, King Ptolemy, and a branch of her roots would be her brother, Ptolemy III. And so Ptolemy III came with an army and attacked the king of the north, and he did prevail. And in verse 8 we read, quote, and also carried captives to Egypt, carried their gods to Egypt, their princes, their precious vessels of silver and gold, and continued more years than the king of the north, end quote. And so it looked as if Seleucus, or Seleucid, was losing out on his plan, which was intended to make friendships between the kingdoms of Egypt and the kingdom of Seleucus, but it produced enmity in the end. You could never have told what was going to happen, but looking back at the history, you can now see how it fits. Go on to verse 9, quote, and so the king of the north shall come into his kingdom and shall return to his own land, end quote. Most interpreters consider that to mean he shall come into the kingdom of the King of the South. You can take it that way, but the Hebrew could be translated either way, and if you take it the way it stands, it could be simply a recapitulation of verses 7 and 8. Bernice was the daughter of Ptolemy II, as we mentioned before, and Ptolemy III was Bernice's brother. And so verse 9 is generally taken as meaning an attempt of the Seleucids to attack Egypt again, which did fail, but it could be simply a summary of the previous verse, so either translation would fit with the facts here. But then as we go on to verse 10, we read, quote, "His son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through and return and be stirred up even to his fortress," end quote. This describes the attempt of King Ptolemy to get vengeance and the fact that eventually there came a king of the north who was very strong. You have on your list Seleucid III, here who reigned for only 4 years, and he was one of the sons of Laodice. He reigned only 4 years when there was a rebellion in the army, and he was killed, and his brother Antiochus III became king. And Antiochus III is called Antiochus the Great, because he would have been one of the greatest figures in ancient history, perhaps not one of the top ones, but very important in the second tier, if it were not for an unfortunate thing that happened at the end of his reign. So this Antiochus III, who is called the Great, is described here in the course of verse 13, right up to verse 19. We have a long description here of the reign of one of the most powerful conquerors in ancient history, but largely forgotten because of the failure at the end of his reign. Now, it describes here how the king of the north comes, in verse 13, with a great army and with riches, and he attacks the king of the south. Now, at this point, we need to remind ourselves of the situation there between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies held Egypt, as I've mentioned many times before, but they also held Palestine and southern Syria. They held that area for 100 years, and the Seleucids had been trying to get possession of Syria and Palestine and to get it away from the Ptolemies. And Antiochus III succeeded in doing so, and when he did so, this is of great interest to the Hebrews because Palestine was very prosperous under the Ptolemies and was getting along quite well under them. But there were some who were dissatisfied, that is, some Israelites who were very unhappy to be under the Ptolemies, and they tried to get their area freed from Ptolemy, which would bring them under the rule of the Seleucids. And if they did that, they thought that they would have more freedom, but actually, it led to the terrible crisis that is described in this chapter under Antiochus IV, also called Antiochus Epiphanes. By the way, Epiphanes means an epiphany, that is, an appearance, because Antiochus IV was thinking of himself as the embodiment of the god Zeus. I will have more to say about that later. And so we read here in verse 14, quote, "In those days there shall many stand up against the king of the south," end quote. Well, Antiochus III was making a series of campaigns against the Ptolemies, and this verse may suggest that there were people who were helping him. It is generally thought that this refers to the time when the king of Macedonia, for a brief period, joined with Antiochus against the Ptolemies. I think, though, it could equally well refer to many in Israel who joined Antiochus, thinking that they would be better off under the Seleucids than under the Ptolemies. You cannot say which, because it merely says many will join. But the next phrase says, quote, "The robbers of your people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall," end quote. Now, what in the world does that mean, quote, "the robbers of your people," end quote? Well, your people is certainly talking about Israelites, and this is considered by all interpreters, I believe, to mean that there were Jews who revolted against Ptolemy, thinking they'd be better off under the Seleucids, under Antiochus III. And so they had a vision, They had an idea that they'd be much better off under the Seleucids, free from the Ptolemies, but, quote, they shall fall, end quote, and actually they were much worse off, as we find out in the latter part of this chapter. But we read, quote, so the king of the north shall come and cast up a siege mount, and come and take the fortified cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be strength to withstand, but he that comes against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. End quote. So from this time on, Palestine, or Israel, and southern Syria are joined with the rest of the Seleucid territory and taken away from the Ptolemies. As we go on to verse 17, we read, quote, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give them the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. End quote. Well, here's the way that was fulfilled. Antiochus III gave his daughter, Cleopatra, yes, the famous Cleopatra, in marriage to the son of Ptolemy IV, now, who is ruling in Egypt, thinking that that would cement friendship between the two countries. But actually, Cleopatra, this is the first Egyptian queen, this daughter of Antiochus III, through her whole influence with her husband and against her father, made it so that this arrangement did not work. Well, for today, you looked at verse 21, which had to deal with Antiochus IV, and if we hadn't taken time to review the test, I think we could have gotten to verse 21 today, but we'll plan to do that next time. So I guess we'll stop at this point. And this is the end of lecture number 9 by Alan McCrae on the prophecies of Daniel.